This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. A bit later in the hour, seven newly discovered exoplanets, all in the sweet spot we've been hearing about it all week. We'll get the details. But first, in January, a woman in Las Vegas died from a superbug, an infection that antibiotics were powerless to treat. The bacteria were resistant to the 14 different antibiotics available at the hospital. That's the latest report of a superbug, but not the first time you've heard that we're heading into a post-antibiotic world. Bacteria are outpacing the roster of drugs that we currently have. The obviously simple question is, why don't we make more antibiotics? If only the answer was that simple. It involves more questions, like where should we look for these new drugs? And what is the trick to formulating a drug that can get past the defenses of a bacterium? Of course, there's always the money. My next guests are here to talk about that. Kim Lewis is the director of the Antimicrobial Discovery Center at Northeastern University in Boston. John Thorson is the director of the Center for Pharmaceutical Research and Innovation at the University of Kentucky in Lexington. Welcome to Science Friday.
Good to be here.
John, you hunt for antibiotics in places that people wouldn't even think to visit. You go to coal mine fires, right? What about the environment made you think there might be valuable antibiotics down there, for example?
Well, microbes or bacteria there's a long tradition for microbes being a source for antibiotics. Drugs like tetracycline, macrolides like erythromycin, the aminoglycoside antibiotics are all produced by bacteria. But one of the challenges in our field really is how do you reduce the percentage of rediscovery? And so the way to do that is to go into areas where people haven't explored. And that's what brought us into coal mines and other environments that really have not been explored in this regard.
And what you found in the coal mine wasn't a new antibiotic, was it? It's a kind of an add-on.
That's right. So the source of these antibiotics or these small molecules are, again, bacteria, and they produce not only molecules that have biological activity, but they also have enzymes that are responsible for making them. And sometimes we can take advantage of those enzymes to do chemistry, and that's really the basis of the study that we recently published.
So it actually improved how the antibiotic worked.
That's right. So it really was, it enabled the chemistry and led to an improvement to an existing antibiotic.
Kim, for how complicated these drugs are, we're still searching for them in pretty, basic places in a pretty basic way. We've only isolated, I think this is one of the most interesting statistics I've been following over the years. We have only isolated a really tiny amount of bacteria from soil bacteria, right? You and your colleagues developed a device that helps with that problem. First, tell us how difficult it is to get bacteria out of soil.
Right. So it is very easy to get about 1% of bacteria from soil to grow on our petri dishes. But then you hit upon the remaining 99%, also known in microbiology as the microbial dark matter, that does not readily grow in the lab. And that is a big problem.
And you found a way around that, a unique way. Tell us about that.
So my colleague Slava Epstein from Northeastern and I had a very simple idea. We will grow bacteria in their natural environment, where, of course, they do grow. So we came up with a gadget, which is called the diffusion chamber. Now, essentially, we take a sample of bacteria from soil, we sandwich it between two semi-permeable membranes, and then that diffusion chamber goes back into the soil. So now everything diffuses through this chamber, meaning nutrients, signaling molecules, and bacteria don't know that we tricked them, and so they start forming colonies. So that is the basic principle of our device.
Do we know why they need to be in their native environment for them to grow?
We know a little bit about it. So one thing that we discovered is that at least some uncultured bacteria require growth factors from their neighbors. And so we isolated at least one class of such growth factors and found that they are necessary for bacteria to acquire iron from the environment. But that explains about 10% of the uncultivability. We still don't know why the 90% of the microbial dark matter doesn't grow.
That's fascinating. I know there are 40 antibiotics in clinical development compared to 700 cancer drugs. Is this really harder than cancer? I mean, why are bacteria so difficult to defeat?
Well, first of all, these 40 is an overestimate. These are mainly analogs of existing antibiotics. And while that is useful, it only gives us a temporary reprieve because resistance develops much faster, of course, to analogs of existing compounds. Mm-hmm. If you look at completely new classes, there's almost nothing in the clinic right now. So the pipeline is really pretty dry for that.
Mm-hmm.
And to address your question, why? Well, there is an interesting paradox in our field of antimicrobial discovery is that we did have once a golden era. As we already discussed, we once had an ability to discover new antibiotics from soil microorganisms, and then that was overmined and that sourced right up. And so now, indeed, the question is where to go and look. And we also look for things that people have not seen before, but we like to look around Boston in our backyards and in places in New England in general. So we are working with a startup company, Novobiotic, collecting soils and growing on cultured bacteria from them. And it is then those bacteria that come from very common environments, but have been uncultured, so have not been seen before, that are producing interesting new chemical compounds.
John, when you take an antibiotic, are you just releasing out millions of molecules, hoping that one will encounter a bacterium? I mean, do they have surface proteins to help the antibiotic recognize it?
We're doing a number of focus screens looking for targeted activities. We're also doing general antimicrobial activity measures as well as we're looking at these new bioactive molecules to try to understand their function.
Mm-hmm. So it's sort of like I'm trying to understand the fascinating mechanism of how drugs work. You take a drug, you take an antibiotic, you release it into the blood. Is it just like you flood the blood, hoping that it links up with a bacterium, and it's sort of hit or miss? So you get enough antibiotic in there.
Well, the fundamental mechanism and the reason why most antibiotics work is they have a mechanism that specifically targets machinery in the target bacterium and don't have any effect on human processes, right? That's what gives you the safety, that gives you the effectiveness of these types of molecules.
Mm-hmm. And John, why is a bacterium so – well, let me ask either one of you. Why is it so hard? Why are they so strong at resisting? What's going on inside the bacterium that's so strong in resisting these drugs?
Well bacteria have a...
Yeah.
Go ahead.
There are two aspects to this. One is that bacteria very rapidly acquire resistance. So if, let's say, you have a wonderful drug that hits a particular protein, then that is going to mutate and your protein is not going to bind the antibiotic any longer. So our best antibiotics, like penicillin, for example, they bind several related targets. But if you're developing a new compound and it binds only one target, then that will be a problem. And the other very big problem is penetration. So bacteria evolved a terrific penetration barrier, their cell envelope, that restricts penetration of compounds that look like drugs. So some antibiotics, of course, are evolved molecules that evolve to penetrate, but we still do not have a very good understanding of which molecules will and which will not penetrate.
Now, Kim, I understand that bacterium have like pumps. They just pump out this stuff once they get in there. Is that right?
That is right. So those compounds that leak through this barrier of permeability, then those will be picked out by pumps and pumped out. And the pump will recognize chemically unrelated compounds. That was a big surprise for us when we found such pumps.
What about the idea of instead of killing the bacteria, we trigger our own immune system to do that for us, Kim?
Well, you know, that's in principle, that is a good idea. That's a promising direction. But our immune system is enormously complex. And of course, the immune system, as you know, Ira, if you overexcite the immune system, you're going to get either septic shock or an autoimmune condition. So it's a very dangerous tool. We really need to know what we're doing to do that. But another aspect of that is, of course, vaccines. Well, vaccines have been around for a long time. And vaccines and therapeutic antibodies are the things that we are using right now.
Mm-hmm. What about, John, about new ideas about how we could administer antibiotics differently? Could we give them differently?
Well, I think, one could take a lesson from the approaches we're taking in antiviral therapy, and that would be to combine drugs with different mechanisms. And one of the points that wasn't addressed previously is that, you know, bacteria rapidly grow, and that contributes to the resistance mechanism. And so when you put them under selective pressure, they have a way to you kill off a large portion of the organisms, but there's a small population that has mutated to get around a particular drug. But if you're hitting them with multiple agents at one given time, that could be advantageous.
All right. Well, there's a lot more to talk about with Kim Lewis, Director of Antimicrobial Discovery Center at Northeastern, and John Thorson, Director of the Center for Pharmaceutical Research and Innovation, University of Kentucky in Lexington. If you want to join us, please, our number, 844-724-8255, and Twitter. You can tweet us at SciFry. We'll come back and talk lots more about this after the break, so stay with us. This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. We're talking about the science behind discovering and developing new antibiotics with my guests, Kim Lewis at Northeastern University, John Thorson, University of Kentucky in Lexington. Now, to develop and distribute a new drug takes a lot of money. Yeah. To find new antibiotics, we may need a new way to put money behind these drugs. There is a small government agency called Biomedical Advanced Research Development Authority, call it BARDA, which came together after the anthrax attacks in 2001. The agency is taking a different approach when it comes to funding. Joe Larson is director of BARDA at the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services in Washington. Welcome to Science Friday.
Thanks for having me.
Would it be fair to say that BARDA is sort of the DARPA for antibiotics?
You could say that. I think another way to put it is that we're almost like a government-backed investment firm who makes investments, you know, in products that help us deal with public health emergencies on behalf of the American public.
Uh-huh. So the agency started CARB-X, which is like an X Prize for antibiotics. How does that work?
So CARB-X, is a novel, basically a global innovation fund that we established to promote innovation in antibacterial drug, vaccine, and diagnostic development. And, you know, what we recognized was that this is a global problem that has, you know, a very far reach. And in order for us to be able to adequately address it, we needed, you know, globally coordinated solutions. And so CARB-X brings together two funders of biomedical research in the U.S., BARDA, as well as the National Institute for Allergy and Infectious Diseases. And it also forms a transatlantic partnership with the Wellcome Trust, which is one of the premier funders of biomedical research both in the UK and in the EU. And together, we've pooled resources to be able to invest basically $450 million projected over the next 5 years at developing early stage antibiotic candidates so that they're able to enter into clinical development. But in addition to just providing funding, we also have put together a network of life science accelerators that, in addition to providing funding and technical support, also provide business and entrepreneurial support to help these kind of early stage startup companies become more sophisticated enterprises.
Mm-hmm. So you sort of have a private-public partnership raising this money from the government, you, and from venture capital firms to get the research funded? I mean, the basic research, what areas most concern you now and where you're looking to fund it?
Right. So, you know, our model is innovative public-private partnerships. And we started this program back in 2010 Since then, we've supported 9 different companies. We've been able to advance 6 different candidate antibiotics into phase 3 clinical development. Our first BARDA-supported antibiotic candidates are projected to enter into the market into 2017 as well as 2018. Historically, you know, the way that we've invested is we invest where there's the greatest unmet medical need. And to date, right now, that's gram-negative bacterial infections, which are these type of superbugs that you described before. Many of our products that we're developing are again, analogs of existing antibiotics that overcome the known resistance mechanisms. And through our investments, through programs like CARB-X, we're hoping to inject some new innovation and some new ideas for new and novel antibiotics, because to be frank, there is a significant dearth of innovation in this space. And you know, you asked the question, is this really harder? And it is harder from a technical perspective, but the underlying basis behind that is really an economic problem.
Mm-hmm. Kim Lewis, what are your thoughts about would BARDA have helped you?
The short answer is no. Although, of course, it's terrific that there is money being poured into this general area, and I'm sure that BARDA supports useful work. But having said that, I participated in several workshops. One was called by the National Institute of Health, the other by Pure Charitable Trust, where a group of experts was asked to identify the bottleneck in the overall process of developing an antibiotic. And there was a consensus, a rare consensus. The bottleneck is not in development. The bottleneck is in discovery. We do not have enough leads to develop. So first we need to figure out how to discover new antibiotics, and then there will be things to develop. So I would really be hopeful that the money will be put into discovery. And there are very specific science challenges and gaps that we identify that need to be solved to provide us with a long-term solution to the problem of discovering new antibiotics, such as figuring out the rules that govern the penetration of molecules in the bacterial cell, or how to better access antibiotics from uncultured bacteria and the silent operants that they harbor, where the genes code for antibiotics, but we cannot easily turn them on in the lab. So mm-hmm. these are some of the examples that we identified as key areas where investment would be very helpful.
John Lewis, where do you think the major bottleneck is when developing new ones, no antibiotics?
So I agree with Kim that investment in discovery is an important component. I believe that also on the academic research side, we have to be realistic about thinking, once you discover a molecule, you have a putative hit. You have to advance that to a certain component, and not all academic research labs or even institutes are sort of set up and thinking in that regard. The end goal here is to position a potential early stage lead for support by a program like BARDA, so that you can put together a compelling data package that says, you know, these molecules have suitable in vivo properties and show suitable efficacy in an animal model. And you can really lay out a case that if a funding agency like BARDA were to invest, it's going to have legs to actually get mm-hmm. it to the point of entering into the clinic.
Joe Larson, we've talked many times about how expensive it is to get a drug to market, and one of the great bottlenecks or is the resistance by drug companies to make new antibiotics because they're expensive to test also. How do you get through that bottleneck? $400 million in your budget might be good for, you know, the basic research, but it's not going to get $100 million clinical trial going.
Right. Well, a lot of the work that BARDA does is actually supporting the clinical development of these molecules. And so, as I mentioned, we've advanced 3 of these programs into phase 3 clinical development. We are supporting the cost of those trials to help get these products into the market. But it's important to know, you know, all that we're doing is we're lowering the R&D costs of these companies to be engaged in this space. And that basically is keeping the companies that have remained in developing antibiotics, at the table doing that. If we really want to promote innovation in this space, if we really want to fix the market failure for antibiotics, we need to be rewarding the innovation that comes with bringing a new antibiotic to market. And we need totally different market models for the ways that we incentivize this industry base to want to participate in this. You can take the last six antibiotics that were FDA approved and project their first 2 years of projected sales ranged between $30 to $80 million. And that may sound like a lot of money, but if you put that toe-to-toe with drugs like Lyrica for diabetic nerve pain or Spiriva for the treatment of COPD, their first two-year sales were in excess of $1 billion or approaching $750 million. And so if you're a private investor, you know, which company are you going to invest in? The company that's developing the billion-dollar blockbuster or the company, the antibiotic company that maybe make, you know, $40 million in its first 2 years? And so, you know, we need to be rethinking the way that we reward these companies. And the way to do that is ensure that we have a market model that rewards innovation, promotes conservation of these products, and then also allows access to the patients that need these products when they're experiencing a drug-resistant infection.
With the new administration in a cost-cutting mood, do you think that BARDA is going to survive in the next budget round?
Well, you know, we have a lot broader, a lot broader of a mission space than just antibiotic resistance. We deal in protecting the American public from mass public health emergencies, and that involves bioterrorism agents. It involves, you know, pandemic influenza. It involves emerging infectious diseases like Ebola and Zika. I hope that, you know, that Congress and the American public views our role as a pretty critical one to keeping our nation safe and would want to sustain that investment. And we're hopeful that that's the case.
We'll find out. Budgets are coming up in the next few days. Thank you, Joe Larson, Director of Biomedical Advanced Research Development at the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services. Kim Lewis, Director of the Antimicrobial Discovery Center at Northeastern University. John Thorson, Director of the Center for Pharmaceutical Research and Innovation, University of Kentucky in Lexington. Thank you all for taking time to be with us today. When is having an abundance of ear hair a good thing? Well, maybe when it kind of reverse deafness. And no, I'm not talking about the fuzzy kind of ear hair you can see on my ears. I'm talking about the sensory hair cells that grow on the inner cochlea, the ones responsible for detecting sound waves. Damage to these little hairs is common among people with some forms of hearing loss. And now researchers are developing a drug that can stimulate progenitor hair cells, giving them the ability to regrow and perhaps restore hearing permanently, perhaps even as an outpatient procedure. Given my percussion deafness, I'm happy to be the guinea pig for this one. With me is Jeffrey Karp, Associate Professor of Medicine at Brigham and Women's Hospital in Boston, Massachusetts. Welcome back to Science Friday.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
Why don't we already have a drug treatment for deafness? It's such a common problem.
Well, I think that, you know, one of the challenges has really been that the biology has been lagging. And, you know, one of the reasons for this is that, you know, it's really simply we haven't had enough of these cells, the hair cells, in the inner ear to conduct a lot of experiments. And I think this lack of, you know, abundance of these cells, even in the laboratory, has really minimized the type of experiments we can perform.
And that's one of the things you've been able to do is get enough of these cells growing in the laboratory so that you can make experiments to try to regrow the hair cells?
Exactly. So, you know, we knew going into this that birds and amphibians like frogs and toads and salamanders, they have the capacity to regenerate these hair cells throughout life. And when humans are born, they lose that regenerative capacity. You're only born with 15,000 hair cells per ear.
Wow.
And throughout life, those cells die and they never regenerate.
And so you actually found by going into the lining of the intestine, the stuff that could regenerate the cells. Why the intestine?
Well, you know, when we started this work maybe 7 or 8 years ago, we were really interested in developing a druggable approach for tissue regeneration. And, you know, we were kind of envious of creatures like sharks that can regrow their teeth throughout life. We were envious of salamanders where you can cut off an entire limb and it regrows or a tail. And we said, you know, why have humans been left out of this regenerative process? And when we take a close look, we actually haven't been left out of this completely. The lining of our intestines can actually regenerate, and it does, every 4 to 5 days. So it's really the most regenerative tissue in our entire body. So it was really a great place for us to start our work.
This is Science Friday from PRI, Public Radio International. So tell us about what success you've had in using these intestine cells so far in the laboratory.
So we started with the there's a stem cell in the lining of the intestine, and that stem cell is really responsible for this incredible regenerative process of you know, every 4 to 5 days regenerating the entire epithelium. And so through trying to really understand the cues of how that cell is regulated, we were able to come up with small molecules, which, you know, really standard types of drugs are small molecules, that could regulate that stem cell and grow it in almost unlimited quantities in pure form.
So is it as simple as injecting the stem cells into the cochlea where the ear cell, where the hair cells live?
So, you know, well, cell-based therapy is definitely something that we're interested in. When we started this work, you know, our idea was just because there's so much complexity around cell-based therapy in terms of expanding the cells and quality control, our idea was if we can target the cells in the body, the stem cells and the progenitor cells, with small molecules, just standard types of medicine, we might be able to have a very powerful approach that could be quickly translated to patients. So the idea here would be to deliver these molecules to the middle ear, and they'd be able to diffuse across a membrane called the round window membrane into the cochlea, which is where these progenitor cells are located.
So you put the drug in, the progenitor cells make the hair cells. So how close are we for, you know, going to the doctor's office and getting this medicine possibly injected into your cochlea?
So we were able to show in the laboratory that we could take these small molecules, we could isolate these progenitor cells from the inner ear, and we could expand those progenitor cells on the order of 2,000-fold beyond what anyone had shown before, and then generate huge populations of these hair cells. And so this work that we recently published was really, you know, a big first step in this effort. We were able to obtain, you know, very large populations of hair cells. We demonstrated that they had functionality, you know, really bona fide hair cells. And we demonstrated this for tissue from mice, non-human primates, and even human tissue. And we formed a company called Frequency Therapeutics, which is in the process of moving this to the clinic, and they hope to begin human clinical testing within about 18 months or so.
That's like tomorrow in the medical world, isn't it? 18 months. You mean the ability to, as an outpatient, to go in, get an injection, and have your hearing come back? That's the idea.
Yes, exactly. And, you know, a lot of people have middle ear infections, and it's a very standard procedure for people to get antibiotics injected into the middle ear. It can be done as a outpatient procedure, you know, in-office procedure. And so we envision really just kind of piggybacking on that type of infrastructure that's already available. And so really the goal here is to get the molecules into the inner ear, so we would just inject them into the middle ear and allow them to diffuse across. And it should be a relatively quick procedure.
Because there's so many people with stem cells. I have stem cell, you know, I had a percussion deafness from a loud bang, and it's in my hair cells, and all other kinds of people with hair cells. This would be really anticipated.
Yeah, I mean, there's so many ways that these hair cells can be damaged from loud noises, and it really doesn't take a long exposure. Age, even common antibiotics like gentamicin, chemotherapeutics, and it's even believed, you know, if you take aspirin at, 10 pills or 12 pills a day, that can also damage these hair cells. And because they never regenerate, you know, people are really, really stuck with this, and there's no therapeutics right now.
All right, Dr. Karp, we're going to meet back here in 18 months, okay? And we'll see how this
sounds great.
This is going. It's fascinating. Jeffrey Karp, Associate Professor of Medicine at Brigham and Women's Hospital in Boston. Well, we're going to take a break. When we come back, scientists got not one, but seven steps closer to finding a planet that might support life. It's the biggest news story of this week. Those seven planets and the, we'll talk about it after the break. Stay with us. We'll be right back. This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. It is not often that scientists make a discovery so big that the whole internet is talking about it. It even made the front page of Google. Well, this week, NASA announced that not one, not two, but seven new Earth-sized planets have been found orbiting a nearby dwarf star. They're in the so-called Goldilocks zone. Not too hot, not too cold. The perfect temperature for supporting life. So how will scientists ever know if these seven planets are similar to Earth? They may be the same size, but maybe not similar to Earth. And if they can sustain life, what do we do then? Well, if there's one person who can answer those questions, it's my next guest, Dr. Sarah Seeger, professor of planetary science and physics at MIT. Welcome back to Science Friday, Dr. Seeger.
Thanks so much, Ira. It's great to be back.
It's good to have you. Now, news of these seven exoplanets, as I said, they're all over the internet this week. Even the Google Doodle got on board. But we have found exoplanets before, so why all the excitement about this discovery?
Well, there's many reasons why. The first, as you've already mentioned, that there are not just one, but seven Earth-sized worlds. And it's like a jackpot, really, for being able to find out the answers to questions we've had for millennia.
These planets are 40 light years away, so how were scientists able to find them?
Well, they found them so 40 light years seems far and away because it's so far away. It's hundreds of millions of miles away, but it's close, astronomically speaking. Mm-hmm. And scientists are able to find it by just monitoring the brightness of the star and looking for a drop in brightness just in case a planet were to go in front of that star. And it turned out that not just one, but seven planets go in front of the star as seen from Earth.
Now, this was from a star, a cool dwarf star. And is this
yes.
the first time that scientists have looked at that kind of star?
In this particular star, yes. But there's a lot of stars that are called, they actually have the letter M, M dwarf star.
Mm-hmm.
They're red stars, they're cooler, they're dimmer than the sun. But in out of all of that category, this star, it's not just called cool dwarf star, it's actually called ultra cool dwarf star.
Ultra. Because,
yeah, you start to run out of adjectives, right? And then this star is so small and so cool, if it were any smaller, any lower mass, it wouldn't even be a star. It wouldn't be able to sustain fusion in its core.
Well, this is a star and a cool star. I know it's like Hollywood. It's cool, man. You know?
It is. But the leader of the project actually purposefully went after the smallest type of stars out there because it's easier to find small planets around small stars
than
small planets around sun-like stars.
That's interesting. How come our star has only one Earth, but this star could have seven?
Aha. Well, that's a great question, Ira. And I'm thinking, actually, if there are intelligent beings elsewhere that are looking back at us, perhaps they're on their own radio show today saying, hey, we just found three planets, three Earth-sized planets. And they'd be thinking of Venus, Earth, and Mars.
Yeah, that's what I was thinking.
I mean, Mars is actually pretty small. But at this point, that would be the equivalent. It's like, wow, we found all these planets. They're all Earth-sized. Some are in the habitable zone. But we need a further look to really narrow it down.
So they've lined up seven orbits and seven planets around the star?
Yes, actually. And we actually knew about, thanks to Kepler and other much more distant stars, we've seen not quite that many planets in a row, but it's amazing. It's so different from our solar system, but for some reason, there are planets all lined up, all compactly packed tightly together. And in this case, we think it's so new, though, people haven't really been able to think about it in great detail yet, but we think the planets must have interacted with each other in a kind of planetary dance, and they came to their lowest energy state by being all lined up together.
So I guess, you know, the first thing we always ask about is it how similar is it to Earth? I mean, and the first thing we talk
okay.
about is water, right?
Right.
Is there water? Could
right.
they, how do we test for that?
Okay. Well, first, I'm really glad that you've been able to articulate similar to Earth because we have no idea whether they're going to be like Earth or not. But we do know how we can find signs of water, and that is by finding water vapor in the atmosphere, because water vapor in a small rocky planet shouldn't be there, because the water vapor would get split apart by particles from the star, by photons from the star, and the hydrogen would escape to space, just like a child who's holding a helium balloon might let it go and it, you know, floats away. Hydrogen is light. It shouldn't be on those planets. So if there's water vapor, then there's most likely a liquid water ocean. And water vapor, by the way, on Earth, it's our biggest greenhouse gas. It's a very powerful gas. It's absorbing very strongly. It makes giant signatures in the atmosphere.
Hmm. So how soon can we find out?
Now, this question really depends on what nature has in store, because if some of them have, like, literally a giant whopping water vapor feature, we might, and that's a kind of very remote possibility, to see water vapor with the Hubble Space Telescope. And indeed, even as we speak, there is Hubble data waiting to be analyzed and more on its way.
Now, I know there's the new Webb telescope is under development. And is that going to be made specifically for looking at exoplanets like this one?
Well, Webb was started 25 years ago, actually. It takes a long time to get a big, fancy, sophisticated space telescope ready. So exoplanets weren't really known about back then. So, but yes, James Webb Space Telescope, we see that as our powerhouse, our new Hubble. It's going to do incredible things, including being able to study many of these planet atmospheres in detail.
Well, if this is 40 light years away, and we think there, you know, there might be signs of water or whatever, that's actually in the realm of one person's life, a round trip message, isn't it? 40 plus 40 is 80.
Yeah, it might be a bit of a stretch, but yes, we're getting there. But I do want you to know that there are a lot. There are lots of planets out there, and we're starting to think that there are planets. Actually, we're confident that there are planets around every star. And so, for example, Proxima Centauri, our very nearest star at 4 light years, also has a planet. And that planet, we know even less about it. Actually, we just know its minimum mass. It's not transiting. It's not going in front of the star, so we can't probe its atmosphere. But we definitely will see more to come.
And what are you most curious about? I mean, as a planetologist, you must be just jumping up and down about a discovery like this.
Well, there's two things, Ira. One is like the go for the gold. Is there life on those planets? I'd say that's what I'm most curious about. But that kind of science fiction type of thoughts aside, really, it's like, what are these planets? I mean, are they like Mercury? Have they lost their atmospheres due to the craziness of the star? Or are they really just, you know, nice worlds like Earth with oceans and continents and clouds and things like that? I think even just knowing the very nature of these planets is what we're itching to get at.
Yeah. And if scientists are able to confirm the presence of water or let's go one step further, even life on one of these planets, do you think that would accelerate research into deep space travel?
Absolutely. And we're even seeing that acceleration now. I will just want to go back one second.
Sure.
We're unlikely to be able to like confirm life, but we can find highly suggestive evidence of life. In fact, already, believe it or not, just the exoplanets already known have galvanized people to actually take space travel and interstellar space travel more seriously than ever before. There's a thing we call the giggle factor. That means, you know, if I tell you something, I'm sure this happens a lot on your show, you just start laughing because it just sounds so silly. So
yeah, we
the giggle
that.
Factor... Yeah, the giggle factor of interstellar travel is diminishing.
Yeah, but it's so far away. I mean, that's why we giggle at it. Tell me how that can happen.
Well, I can tell you about some of my colleagues who are working on a project called Starshot. And that actually is a Breakthrough Foundation project. What they're thinking is, there's still a lot of history behind this idea, but it's to send thousands of tiny little spacecraft that you could fit one in the palm of your hand. And they do have 19 challenges. They've listed them all out for all of us to read and ponder. But if they can put them in space and beam intense radiation at them and accelerate these to 20% the speed of light, then a trip to Proxima Centauri would be 20 years, which is still a very long time, but not as long as 80 years.
So you're saying we would push these tiny little things with light. We'd push them and accelerate them that way.
Right. Push them and accelerate them. And they would go to Proxima Centauri B and they would snap a few photos and send them back to us.
Do you ever wonder that maybe we don't want anyone to know that we're here?
No. I don't know. I like the thought that if there's I like the thought that, you know, if they're intelligent enough and sophisticated enough, they already know we're here.
Okay. I'm going to bring on another guest. This is so fascinating. Laura Truey is Director of Citizen Science and co-investigator for Zooniverse at the Adler Planetarium in Chicago. Dr. Truey, welcome to Science Friday.
Happy to be here.
Are you excited by this as well as Dr. Seeger is?
Incredibly. And I love your show. I mean, every week you celebrate discoveries in science and the process of science. And so what's fun for me is to be able to come on and invite your listeners directly to participate in that exploration and discovery process. So pretty much every topic you cover, and including this exoplanet discovery, your listeners can jump in and help researchers directly with it. And that's through citizen science.
Well, thank you. Tell us how our listeners can be involved with this.
Yeah, so specifically for exoplanets, if that's your thing, you can go online right now into planethunters.org and help the research team sift through Kepler space satellite data and identify previously undiscovered exoplanets. And there's already been a number of discoveries led by just members of the public through this online site looking at Kepler data.
When you meet Kepler data, are we actually looking at photos of possible things, or is it numbers and stuff?
So it's a similar process to this week's exoplanet discovery. The researchers looked at the light curves from the star, and we're looking for dips in that light curve. And whether you're a 5-year-old or a 95-year-old, our ability to recognize patterns is really sophisticated. And so it's super low barrier to entry. You can just go onto the site, look at a light curve, just how light changes over time, and look for dips. And through that process, a couple years ago now, some of the volunteers on Planet Hunters saw a 4-star system with planets around it. And that was the first of its kind, and it's only because of their human eye ability to recognize patterns that they saw this. And it was something that the computer automated algorithms hadn't been trained to look for yet.
So they got to be part of a research paper then.
Yes, definitely. They were part of the analysis and very much co-authors on the paper.
Wow. Sarah, how do you feel about these amateurs getting involved in this work?
I love this, and you have no idea how important they are, because we're good with computers, we love programming, but honestly, we can only program mundane, everyday things. It's really hard to spot that really unusual star. And I just want to add that I tell all my people about Planet Hunters. It's from my children to my students to postdocs to my faculty friends. Anyone who wants to work on exoplanets and finding planets with the transit technique should really start there, because getting used to data and seeing tons and tons and tons of real data is really critical.
I'm Ira Flatow. This is Science Friday from PRI, Public Radio International. Laura, how much time does an average person need to devote to this kind of project?
It really ranges from volunteer to volunteer. So we have 1.5 million people who are registered volunteers through our umbrella organization site, which is Zooniverse. And some people come in and just spend 5 minutes. And that's a huge and important contribution. And they can do, on Planet Hunters, for example, they can do a couple classifications. Some people do 50,000 classifications each. And so they spend hours on the site. But whether it's a little bit of time or a lot of time, all of it is useful. And importantly, it's not just classifying, but for those who want to engage more deeply in the process of science and that discovery, they can go into the discussion forum and interact directly with the research team and ask questions and answer questions together.
Citizen science. It's great. It's a great idea. Sarah, where do we go next with your planets, your 7 planets here? What comes next? What will be the next step?
Well, in the short term, I'm sure there will be a flurry of speculative research papers on pretty much every topic, from how they formed to whether or not they have atmospheres to what the chances for life are. But I would keep your eye on any results coming out of the Hubble Space Telescope. And notwithstanding that, we'll have to have a bit of a pause for getting real data for a bit longer. But actually, you know, Ira, when we make a discovery like this, really people put every kind of telescope on the system. And there's the Kepler K2 mission that right now is actually observing the field of stars where the TRAPPIST-1 star is. So there's some chance, some outside chance, they might even find more planets in the same system.
And what constellation is it near?
That's a good question. It's actually near the southern hemisphere, but I don't remember offhand.
So I can't go in my backyard and put my little Celestron C8 on it.
It's a very faint star. It's actually, when we talk about magnitudes, it's magnitude 18 or 19. It's super faint and super dim and invisible wavelengths.
It's not going to be like the Orion star, Betelgeuse.
No.
That kind of.
It's not.
It's not going to see that. And Laura, how do people sign up if they want to be citizen science?
So you can just go directly to planethunters.org, and you can sign in, or you can participate without signing in. And then if exoplanets isn't your thing, there are 52 active projects on Zooniverse, meaning 52 different research teams with cutting-edge science inviting you to help. So from cancer research to ecology to climate science to transcribing Civil War telegrams. So there's a whole range of topics which you can help scientists directly with.
I mean, you know, I'm reminded we had an author on recently about a book of the women who volunteered at the turn of the century, 100 years ago, looking at the plates, looking for all the moving.
Yeah,
stuff.
The Harvard computers.
Yeah.
There's a long history of citizen science, and it's because anybody can do this. I have two little girls, and it's just embedded in us the curiosity and wonder, and so it's now just giving people access to that through sites like Zooniverse to participate directly.
Pretty. And Ira, I just actually checked. It's Aquarius. It's in the constellation Aquarius.
Of course.
TRAPPIST-1.
Of course it's in Aquarius. We people from the 60s would have guessed that it's the dawning of the...
Right. That's exactly what one of the comments was that I read recently. That's the age of Aquarius.
It would have, makes only sense. History repeating itself. I want to thank you both for taking time to be with us today. We're going to be watching this. And you say, Sarah, stuff from the Hubble, we should be watching for that coming out?
We should be watching for it, but remember, we're not sure what nature has in store. We might just not see anything because Hubble can only look at a very narrow wave band, and it's not the most appropriate or powerful tool for these planets.
But it's already making observations at this point.
It is. It's right. Already making observations. In fact, it already observed two of the TRAPPIST planets a few months earlier.
So somebody knows and is not saying.
That particular one was published, and they didn't see anything there.
Oh, okay.
But we'll stay tuned.
That's our motto here. Thank you, Dr. Seeger. Sarah Seeger, Professor of Planetary Science and Physics at MIT. Laura Truitt, Director of Citizen Science and Co-Investigator for Zooniverse at Adler Planetarium. And you can find links to Zooniverse Citizen Science Projects on our website at sciencefriday.com/exoplanets. And while you're there, check out our spotlight on the search for life beyond Earth. You can find related articles and videos and more at sciencefriday.com/lifebeyond. BJ Lederman composed our theme music, and our thanks, as always, to our production partners. We owe them a great debt at the studios of the City University of New York. And at Science Friday, is not Friday, just Friday anymore. We're there all week on Facebook and tweeting away. So stay with us all week long. Have a great weekend. I'm Ira Flatow in New York.